Never before that I can remember have I spent this much time consecutively preaching on one verse. In Psalm 18, two verses. In one of the accounts. But there's a reason. You remember, I've told you many times, if God says something more than once, or repeats himself, pay particular attention. We've been dwelling in Psalm 18 as part of our excursion in faith to demonstrate what God's book provides for what the lifestyle of Romans is from faith to faith. But I haven't emphasized, except in sort of fleeting reference, this passage of which a part of it, believe it or not, that does make sense as we pull it apart. That's part of Psalm 18, 1 and 2, picking up at the point of the shield where I was last Sunday. Now, this particular prayer, I like to call it. Now, there's in the New Testament what's called the Lord's Prayer, a total misnomer. One of the proofs of his uniqueness of all respected founders of religion, he never taught or prayed the prayer his disciples prayed. The Lord's Prayer is in John 17. The so-called Lord's Prayer ought to be renamed the Disciples' Prayer. Because he said, when ye pray, say this. He could never pray it. Because it includes, Father, forgive us our trespasses. He didn't have any. But if I were to put in the Old Testament a prayer for human beings in need, this would be it. Now, I have dinned it in these last weeks. God wants you to be personal. He wants you to understand what he wants to be with and to you, as revealed in his names. And as Martin Luther once said, and I repeated from last Sunday, the personal pronouns distinguish your relationship. Now, there's a difference between me, 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 and obeying what Isaiah 50 said, when you're in darkness and have no light, trust in the name of the Lord, and when you find the one that fits you, stay. Throw an anchor down on your God. What distinguishes David so much in this prayer is the personal. My God. My rock. My shield. And if I could offer a prayer for Christians in need, this would be it. And it's backed up by being repeated three times. We've already emphasized Psalm 18. That's where I'm camping out. We've already emphasized 2 Samuel 22, which gives the historic situation where the song was sung. We haven't emphasized Psalm 144, which predates 2 Samuel and predates Psalm 18 as probably the first utterance of this prayer which shows that David was accustomed to print. But I want to show you some significant differences which will help you understand why I write these languages on the board and seek to pour through the English translation or any of the other modern translations to find, as best we can, what God really said in the context and in the words used as we pursue it through the documents when first uttered or inspired to be uttered by David. Let me show you some things. Let's go to Psalm 18 first, to bring us right into the context of today. Open it in the King James. How many of you have the King James Bible? Open it up, Psalm 18. You ought to have the margins marked up by now. Unless you think it's going to be just a review, we're going past the shield where we were last Sunday to the horn of my salvation. Now that seems a simple enough phrase, doesn't it? Everybody knows what a horn is, depending upon which kind of horn you're talking about. Right? And everybody knows what salvation is. We discovered that early on, didn't we? In the Roman series. And if somebody shows up late in this heat, if they came here instead of the beach, you let them in. And let me explain some of the rules of the house. If you've got weak kidneys, I can sympathize. Because I don't preach 20-minute messages. Now, there's probably a delicate way to say this. Like when I had the symptoms of cancer before God healed me 2.5 years ago. And I can tell you, those symptoms have not come back. And the PSA is on the way down. God's going to win this victory as he did before. But listen to me. I was watering the flowers every hour all night long. Some of you have that problem. Just do me this favor, because when I'm done today, you will see how much I'm trying to contain. I can go for 5 hours if I didn't have to constrict it down. And I don't want to lose the flow when that another voice kicks in. So if you know you've got that problem, ask the usher if you can sit near the rear. That way you don't parade to all of us what your problem is. If you're getting up here on the third row, George, get up and walk about halfway back there. While I'm preaching, go on back there. Now, come on back. Everybody knows what his problem is when he does that. And I told you my symptoms when I had cancer because I needed your prayer. Sit near the back. And if you have to go to the restroom, I got a message from the head usher this past week. And I wrote a note on the bottom of it. Do I have to wipe your nose? He wanted to know, if someone needs to go to the restroom, do I just let them go or do I wait until a more convenient time, which suggests when I turn toward the board? No. I'm sort of adjusted that anybody that moves has got weak kidneys or something worse. Are you clear?
Yes, sir.
Just don't telegraph it. And I have, and then I wrote on the bottom of that note from the head usher, and all this will be edited out for the other stations, so it's sort of nice to be able to talk to you at home and then think of the shock of some of these people that are coming here. And I told them to run a crawl from now on, that it's the services from 11 to 1. Just think of the shock of these people that listen to the hour, which is edited down to the message and an opening song and a closing song. And they have to sit here for 2 hours. And that question do I wait a more convenient time? Having been there before God healed me, there ain't no convenient time. When it comes, it comes. Now, are we understanding each other?
Yes, sir.
We welcome all of you first-timers. We never expose you, so we don't want you to expose yourself. And when you're gone, bring them back and let them sit in the back. They can stay away from their wife till I finish the message. And probably some of you husbands will thank me for that. Or vice versa. Does he know where he is? Yeah, I do. You know exactly where I am. You got the King James open? I'm going to go to the horn of our salvation. But let's move through this now in the King James, since you have been enlightened these many weeks. I will love thee. Arhamka is the word. You know that. It contains the word for womb in the middle. It's a word that doesn't exist with that connotation in most languages, but it has the same word in the Syriac, spelled differently with their script. But it's the love that a mother who carries the child and the connection that a child has to his mother. We can't really define it. It's just a very unique and intense kind of love. Arhamka is what's used here. You'll find another passage, he changes it to hasad, which is a steadfast kind of love, but not the same. Arhamka, only a child to its mother, a mother to its child, and thus you and I, the creature, to our Creator, and that feminine side of God that comes out in the name El Shaddai, that we've taught on many times, the mother pictures of God. Too bad most feminists are so ignorant of the Bible, they can't find these verses. They listen to me, it might help them, but they can't stand listening to me because I recognize they're superior, but I'm not going to yield any ground. And they don't know whether I'm serious or not, and that's good. The Lord, Yahweh, I will love thee, Arhamka, my strength, he's key, which has that word you're now getting familiar with, ooze. Psalm 84, where this series started, blessed is the man whose strength is in thee, that inward strength that is implanted by God in those who trust him. To link it to Romans, I start faith. From faith to faith. He puts things in me. My strength, the Lord Yahweh. My rock. They say the Lord is my rock. You notice the is in italics. O Lord, my rock. Sali, the smitten rock. And I don't want to waste time on review I've done many times. And my fortress, womb, sudati, a high place, fortified, impregnable. And my deliverer, remember that one, I'll get to it later. It has a special connection to what we'll do when we talk about salvation. My deliverer, womb falti, remember that word, falat or falat, whether harsh or soft. I drew the analogy out of the farmer who's raising cows and producing calves and has to help the delivery. I drew the connection to the delivery room. That's why the word delivery is being used here. It's to set free out of containment. Umphalte is that palat verb that is to bring out of a confined space and escape. My strength, no, my God, Eli rather than Yahweh, my strength, you have a note in the King James to the margin that says rock, but it's a different word for rock, Suri, in whom I will trust. Ek Hasibo is the Hebrew. Hase, You know that word, but now one of the three words for faith, hossa, run to a shelter. I will run to shelter in you, that my shelter is you. My buckler, that shield, and that was last Sunday's message. And the horn of my salvation, which is where I am today. Now let me see if I can isolate it from the... Here's the Hebrew. Let me put the green around it here. Wekarim. Yeshi. Conjunction and. Kareen horn. Connected. Of the salvation of me. Yeshi. Remember that. We're going to go back to it. Now turn to 2 Samuel 22. Real quickly, as I lay this foundation. First verse, and David spake, am I warn you? Unto the Lord the words of this song, in the day that the Lord had delivered him out of the hand of all his enemies and out of the hand of Saul. Now that means he's well into late middle or old age, and he's singing a song that he has sung repeatedly, which is what I'm taking this laborious time this morning to impress upon you and myself. We need to habituate ourselves with this song and its meaning until it becomes part of the woof and fabric of our very nature. Here he's singing it in his late middle or old age, having experienced this as his portion from God and the result as a beneficiary of his faith. But notice he doesn't say here, or the translation doesn't have it, the second verse leaves out what we read first in the first verse of Psalm 18. You don't see, I will love thee, O Lord, do you? It starts right out with what's the second verse in Psalm 18. And he said, the Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer. And it's the same as Psalm 18 in the distinction between Soli and Suri, the split rock and the solid rock. God of my rock, in him will I trust. He's my shield and the horn of my salvation and my high tower, which we won't get to today. But then he adds something. In this one, it's God added, and my refuge, my Savior, thou savest me from violence. Same song, but an additional line and shorter line. The front leaves a line out, and the back adds a line. Got that? Let's go to what is probably the first time that he sang it. As a boy, I'm sure he had reflected as he fought the bear and the lion, as a boy and shepherd of his father's sheep, Psalm 144. Now, don't ask me to explain to you the inner thoughts of the Jewish rabbis who put the psaltery together. That's like saying this hymn book that I usually carry with me. How come the first verse, first song's not Amazing Grace? And why we got a bunch of songs that Christians sing, In My Father's House and Honey in the Rock and He Keeps Me Singing, and Amazing Grace is in the wrong place. It comes after all that. Of course, Amazing Grace is true all along. The hymnal is put together for worship services. There's four books of Psalms. We don't note that in the King James. They're just all strung together. Psalm 144 was written about the time that he killed Goliath. 144. And Psalm 18 is written after he's defeated all of his enemies, from Goliath to Saul to the Philistines to Absalom to his old age. I still remember my granddad's brother saying, "If God wants you to understand the Bible, why didn't write the damn thing until you can understand it?" And he muttered like that. I'll say it more clearly to you. "If God wants you to read the Bible, why didn't write the damn thing until you can understand it?" He said that. But it is confusing sometimes. Ezra and Nehemiah are the historic records of the prophets Haggai and Zechariah. Haggai and Zechariah are prophesying while Ezra and Nehemiah are leading the return and the building of the temple in Jerusalem. And Nehemiah has as his primary prophet Malachi, who's the last guy in the book. Don't expect to read the Bible through and have it make sense in a consecutive time frame like you're reading a history book. Likewise, the Psalms. If you want to know when David first wrote this, go to Psalm 144, where I'm going. He starts out, and you'll see something in this psalm when you read all of it after you go home. He is petitioning. This is what facing a problem, he's going to pray the prayer and expect God to do. By contrast, Psalm 18, he's looking back and seeing that God has done and been what this prayer proclaims in Psalm 144. Psalm 144, he's facing a life and a big problem right in front of him, Goliath. Psalm 18, he's toward the end of a life, and what he asked God to do at the front, he now reflects God's been doing. You understand that? I want to end that way, and I want this church and those who listen to me to understand that Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. That God is just as faithful to His Word as He was in David's day. And if this prayer will become your life pattern, you will, as David, be able to look back and sing, and whatever's left, look forward and sing with more certainty. This is what God is and has been for me. Let's go on the front side, Psalm 144. Here he's facing Goliath. "Blessed be the Lord, my strength." The word is surely rock. "Blessed be the Lord, my strength, my rock, which teacheth my hands to war and my fingers to fight." Well, now, we don't face giants giving us a physical threat of our life. Our battles are not in the wilderness area being pursued by enemies. Oh, we're getting a fresh understanding of what war is. And it's not by accident we dropped this flag. And I could depart on that subject, but I think that you've got eyes to see, and maybe it will quicken us with that physical battle that's going on to a fresh understanding of what Christians face in ordinary life. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. From cancer cells to afflictions of all type, to the spiritual battles of your daily life. "He teacheth my hands to war and my fingers to fight." How? By doing this. hanging on God's promise and faithing. My goodness, I'm going to say my goodness, what a bad translation. And they don't help it much when they go to the margin and have mercy. No, it's chesed. Love of me. Not the arhamka. He hasn't yet, he's just starting out. He hasn't yet matured to the realization of how deep and how inseparable God's love to him, like the mother with the child she wounds. At this stage, he's saying, Asad, Asadi, my love of me and my fortress, same word, Umsadati, my high tower. That's rather strange. My high tower stronghold. That comes late in Psalm 18. Mishgabi. That's what we're going to go to next Sunday. So he's got Mishgabi here way up at the front, my stronghold, because he's facing the giant. That's the last word of Psalm 18. Mishgabi of that verse. And that's next Sunday. But he moved it up here. He in whom I trust. Same words again. The one I run to as a shelter. Then he has this phrase added. Who subdueth my people under me. Now we've got three versions, and they're all a little different. You notice that? This being too heavy for you? Which one's right? All of them. Understand that? All this proves is that David penned his psalm somewhere, sometime. And it became a song sung by him and sung by those in his kingdom as he would testify to what God had done. When it came time for the historian in 2 Samuel to write the history and put the psalm as the song of his life that he would sing at the end of his victories as he sung at the beginning when Goliath was the giant facing him, they have sources we don't have circulating. Psalms. For example, I put it up temporarily. We have in the room of the book and in the room of the Torah where it will not stay a full temporary copy as we wait for hard copies that are on the way in the months ahead. That marvelous scroll, the most complete scroll found at Qumran, the Dead Sea Scrolls, Isaiah. Significance, I've referenced in other messages, it's unrolled in color photocopies of all of it, connected in a paper scroll in that sense. I don't want it in the room of the Torah. I'll move it out as we get more space and other Dead Sea Scroll things will be added. But in the Dead Sea Scrolls is the proof that the psaltery had taken permanent shape by that first century where the Dead Sea Scrolls are dated by the closing up of those caves and the fall of Jerusalem when Tatian came. Now, or Titus, now we have proof that the Psalms included 151. We have an extra psalm in an older manuscript than anything that was available when our Bible was translated. And the reason we go through these different routes to get back to what in the German they call the Vorlage, the original pattern, is to get as close as we can to the original statement. What we have here is three different looks at a song written by David, and they would, either from different manuscripts or selecting the rhythm of the song. Remember, the Psalms were sung. So it's not unusual they'd leave a line out that they felt was said partially or adequately by another word in the song. What we have in this prayer is the beauty of three branches from the same root serving a different purpose. The look of teenage David starting his life and singing this song as he faced Goliath. The look of David, this elder statesman, who looks back on his life and selects out of his own song. And perhaps the psalmist, to make the song flow better, left a line out. And you have the historian taking whatever psaltery he had. And remember, even now we break them into four books. We know they were separate. Book one, book two, book three. Like four song books. The beauty is, this prayer, we got all the facets of the diamond. And what God, through these voices, is saying. And with that broad-based background, I bring the focus meter down to just this one phrase. I hope, having emphasized how important God, who guides His oracle book, felt this prayer was, to locate it in these three different frames of reference. But now bring the focus meter down. The horn of my salvation. I don't need to say too much about the kind of horn, because the language is very clear and it flows through all the languages. The horn of my salvation. Skipping over the Aramaic for a moment. The Syriac, clearly, and the horn of Re'eh. My salvation. Now I got to skip over that one because it's not saying what this is saying. Neither is the Septuagint Greek. They're saying, and Keras, the horn, soterios, soterion, sozo, the verb soterios. You've heard this word for salvation. I've talked many times about it. It's one of the hardest words to translate in other languages, and I will break it apart a little bit more in a few minutes. But it's not, the horn business is not too much in debate. The horn in the Greek, the horn in the Syriac. The only one that doesn't want to talk about the horn is the Aramaic, and I'll talk about that. We have both translations of the Vulgate in the Latin, directly from the Septuagint and directly from the Hebrew. Both use a cornu salutis, but I'll have something to say about their choice of word for the salvation of me, mine shield and horn meines Heils in the German. No problem with the German. They're saying horn, mon bouclier, la force, a little different, qui me sauve, so, mi escudo, that's the shield, la fuerza de mi salvacion, or salvacion, get the French out of the Spanish, mi salvion, salvacion, salvacion. Accent on the end, salvacion. The Italian, il mio scudo, that shield, e il corno, horn, della mia salute. That saves me. the horn that saves me. And this is the high tower that comes later. So we don't have much deviation on the word horn. The problem is this word that everybody understands. Yeshi. Everybody knows what salvation is, don't they? Huh? I wish I had erased this board so I had more room, because I'm not going to get to that today, but these foreign languages over here do not deviate much, so let me try this. Yeshi, or Yeshia. Remember a few weeks ago, I wrote down three words that are alternately translated by the Greek Septuagint with soterion, or soterius, or forms of sozo. And I said, these are words that in the King James are all translated salvation. Remember? I wrote down Yeshi. Well, it's Yosha, if we put it in the verb form. She adds the personal pronouns, salvation of me. Remember I wrote down Netzal? Or Notzel? And I distinguish between the meanings. This is deliverance from the oppressor. And this is deliverance from the condition of being oppressed or escape. You remember that? How many were here when I did that? I just put it over here on the corner anticipating coming to this point. How many remember? And there was a third word, which I've simplified because I think that it creates a visual image that makes it easy to remember, to cab. I can't pronounce that in English. How do you say to calve? It's like I can't frill my R's. C-A-L-V-E. I can't say that. Calve. Can you say that? I got more fights as a kid because they mocked me because I couldn't frill my R's. I can't do it yet. That's why these Latin languages are so... Read them, no problem. Speak them. Well, I can't do that. Remember this, when I did this? Stay with me, because I want you to go out of here understanding the distinctive meaning of this word, Yahshua. I want to tell you why it's important. This word is not found, though there are Semitic languages, loan the words back and forth between Ethiopic, Arabic, Aramaic, Hebrew, Syriac, Hindustani, Pakistan. All the languages have common cross-fertilization, like we have common words in our language frame between the English, the Latin, the French, the German, and the Spanish. Except in proper names. In proper names, this word drifts into other languages. Joshua, Isaiah, Jesus. They shall call his name Jesus, the angel said, because he shall save his people from their sins. Now, if there's any subject that Romans is concerned about, it's salvation by faith. Therefore, I can't think of anything more important for us to learn than the salvation that is promised to us. Instead of it taking on different meanings, as I will show you, it's done in the other languages, because, except in proper names, this language, this word doesn't exist. It didn't drift. It does not exist in the other Semitic languages. All through the biblical period, It was almost exclusively used with God as the subject and His people as the object. Sometimes artificial subjects were named as they can't save you. But this word was used almost exclusively of the miracle-saving ability of God. For example, in Exodus 3 and Exodus 6, the classical locale of Israel's beginning, more so than Abram. He was the seed and the root. But they mark their uniqueness as a nation when God delivered them out of Egypt's bondage, which is the type of God's deliverance of us from sin. Understand? In the 3rd chapter and the 6th chapter, Nishi's not used. Those two chapters are permeated with the second word. Netzel. Netzel. What he did was, I'm going to coin a word, Nislam, out of Egypt. Because that is deliverance from the condition. And just like the precision of God's revelation pointing ahead to the time of redemption, distinguish between when to use Sali and Suri. And I don't need to go into that again, get the previous messages. Once again, deliverance out of Egypt, read it when you go home, 3rd chapter and 6th chapter of Exodus, Nisal. But when you come to the deliverance where Miriam is going to dance and sing, where God drowned Pharaoh and his army in the Red Sea and took them miraculously across that sea and wiped out their oppressors, Ishi, not Netzel. This is salvation with a bang. Get rid of your oppressor. Then you already had the third word I wrote down, which was Palat. Put a dot in there, Palat. Or Palat in the earlier word in Psalm 18. And my deliverer, Wumphalti. Same word, which I've already said is to calve. Take you out. Now today I want to introduce a brand new word. The RP R Kof, the Q sound. If you reverse the Hebrew, which is writing from right to left, it's P R Q. Put the vowels in, Parak. Now, when we come to the Aramaic, we were here last Sunday in the Aramaic, which is the translation dating clear back to Nehemiah, when the people came back from Babylon and didn't speak Hebrew, and they rediscovered the scrolls in Hebrew, having returned to Jerusalem in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. And in Nehemiah 8, they read from the scrolls as the people stand, and then the rabbis gave the meaning or translated, as Targumim, their word for translator, translated the Hebrew into the language they understood, which is the Aramaic, ultimately written down in what are called the Targums, which is the Aramaic translation, which takes us to the rabbis of that day, clear back to Nehemiah's case, given the sense, as they understood it, of the Hebrew in another language. They didn't have Deshi. They weren't willing to do, I guess, what I'm willing to do. Tell you what it means and then adapt it into our language until, you know, you've learned words that are very useful. It's a code between us. You can speak some of these words, nobody else knows what you're saying, because we use them in a context, out of context. They wouldn't do that. They hunted for a word because they didn't have Yosha. Yosha wasn't there. So they come up with Tokov, or Tekov, which is strength. Why they put that there, I don't know, but it will make more sense when I go into the next facet of it. But the word I'm really wanting to concentrate on, they didn't say horn, they said strength. Now, they had a word for horn, but as I've already told you, they just would not, in the Aramaic targums, they would not use natural objects like rocks. They would get some spiritualized term for it. And therefore, instead of rock, they use strength. And instead of horn, they use the same word again, if you could read the whole thing in Aramaic, strength. And then they use the word that I've just written over there. Take out the vowels and the syntax. P-R-Q. Rock. Now, that word has taken the place of Yeshi. Because they didn't have a word for Yeshi. The Syriac does the same. Three letters in the Syriac. Give me a camera, somebody. Get over here. Don't be afraid to walk. There are people out there that got to see it on TV. See these letters? That's Fa or P. This is R. And this is Q. So transferred in to their particular script, we have the same letters again. P, R, Q. And it means essentially the same. Even the Arabic. Even the Arabic has the same three letters, P, R, Q. In every case, that's an intensive word. And by the way, just so you know this, the Hebrew has the same word. The only difference is this is the Hebrew. Paul, no, that's Palat. Where are we? Down here. Parak. If it's a Hebrew, you have different vowels. And the Aramaic, they just change the vowel. One vowel here. Either Parak or Parak. In each case, Hebrew has the same word, Parak, which I can add as the four. Now you can find your corner over there somewhere. The three words, I now add a fourth one, which in the Hebrew, parak, is the one that is picked up to translate Yeshi. Are you with me? Because Yeshi did not transfer to the other languages. They didn't have a word. Like they didn't have a word for Haromka, except for the Syriac that did transfer. There's probably a prejudice involved because the Jews like to use this word only in regard to Israel. They felt that God was their God, Yahweh, and He would only save their gang. So there were pressures to keep the word from leaking out because it had this aura like Yahweh. You don't find Yahweh being adopted by other nations and tongues, although it went into the Aramaic, and they just put a couple of apostrophes down for it. The word that was picked is a Hebrew word, also carried as a cognate, same letters, different script, Syriac, same letters, different script, Arabic. I can go on out in Penida. If I knew Hindustani and all the other Aramaic languages, probably the same thing there. What does this word mean? Let me just bore you with detail for a moment, if I can find my glasses again. You can go to the various dictionaries, you who read these languages. In the Hebrew, this word means to tear apart. No, this one. To tear apart. Parak. To tear apart or to tear away. The Syriac, same word, P, Resh, Kaf, same word, to withdraw, and it's intransitive. It's an act of withdrawal, remove, or rescue, which puts it close to Palat. It's still not Ishi. Arabic has the same word, as I said. Same word, Fa, Ra, Kaf, and it simply means to split or to divide. In the Aramaic, where you just change the vowel to a vocal Shiva, and it means to redeem or to rescue, not Yeshi. Now, are you interested enough in salvation to hear me out? As I pull from the scholars of note, I want to tell you something else, though, en route. As you plot the Bible and move to the period where the prophets are lamenting the loss of genuine relationship with Jehovah, in the messages I preach where they lament that Shub was just a ritual and a form, repentance, in other words, and not a relationship personal of complete remorse and seeking of help from God to change. When the miraculous went out, Yeshi began to die out. Until there's a humorous story, Nayishani, Shai is the cry for help from this. And there's a humorous, not very humorous, but I think it's apocryphal, of a woman that was drowning in a lake and was crying, Shai! And she drowned because none of the modern Hebrews understood the word. There's a cry for help. I went in just out of curiosity in Oxford's English Hebrew Dictionary of modern Hebrew. Went to the word for help and save. And they don't have Yashi. Not there in this dictionary. Not there. They've got Uzar, Mia, as aid and help. They've got Kabod. They've got Gimgi. They've got Hoyil, they've got Nimni, they've got, again, Uzer, and on it goes. For aid and serve and prevent and be useful and prevent and help out and remedy. Not there. It fell into disuse. Even you can note it as the scriptures move on to later years into the prophets. They were no longer a people who understood and lived in the help zone of the Savior. Their view turned to flesh from the miraculous delivery that Yishi is. Now, I will hopefully not bore you too much as I take this theological dictionary of the Old Testament, so new in scholarship that the 12th volume just came out, if not finished even yet. And just this past week, I was finally able to get the 12th volume. Scholars around the world, more of them than the committees that did the King James. I think I need two sets of glasses, maybe three, that I can leave at each location. Let's talk about this word, Yishi. There are 14 proper names. And apart from proper names, it does not occur outside the Hebrew. And it's reserved almost exclusively for theological usage, with Yahweh as the subject and His people as the object. In the noun form, it's the commonest soteriological, and also the verb, term in religious context, but rarest in everyday language. It doesn't have any application in everyday language. God's the subject. The subject is almost without exception Yahweh or His appointed representative. Yishi, or Hoshea, implies bringing help to those in trouble rather than rescuing them from it. Now you're starting to see the difference between Nisal and this one. It bringing help to those in trouble rather than rescuing them from it. As between Egypt's army and the Red Sea. Stand still and see the Yoshi, salvation of the Lord. Who knows I can read about this without boring you all day? Well, I think that's probably enough. All the synonyms that are being used, it's oftentimes linked to metaphorical things, the shield of your salvation, the rock of your salvation. It involves God coming and giving you the rescue in the midst of your trouble. For example, this is what I'm looking for. Yahshua comes to those in need like a light or like walls and ramparts round a beleaguered city. It does not remove or rescue them. It comes to you in your situation and removes it. Now, of course, you can see immediately, parenthetically, where Gene Scott's living on this. I mean, look out, cancer. I mean, look out, cancer. This is a salvation where He comes where you are and does what you cannot do. They're trying, give them credit, for this word parak is a tear-apart concept. I'm going to give you some more synonyms of the Hebrew and the Aramaic word. It's to break, to separate, to untie, to unloose, to unload. And as I said, tear-apart in a way. As the Greek sought in the most intensive Greek word for love, agapao, to translate what was untranslatable from the Hebrew, or hamka, that links the mother-child love relationship. All of these translators are trying to pick a word that involves intense action, an intense entrance into the scene, but they make it more an intense escape from rather than an entrance in to save in the situation. We're dead in trespasses and sins. You want me to go to Romans? We're hopeless, as I will show you as we go through the third chapter. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. The whole message of redemption from heaven's glory, our Savior stepped into a tent of human flesh made in likeness of sinning flesh, knew no sin, faced all of the same temptations we face, knew no sin, and gave himself for us, raised to implant in us the power that raised up Christ from the dead and deliver us from the clutches, having snatched from Satan's hands the keys of death, hell, and the grave. Victory in Jesus is the way this service started. But he comes where we are, doesn't just suck us out from a distance. I mean, he's right down there on the ground, fighting the enemy, knowing, having been there, tempted in all points as we are, what our condition is. They shall call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. Now, I'd like to show you, we've already said the Aramaic then is using parak, which is to tear apart, separate, escape, intensively get in there with something that sets you free, but it's not limited to God doing it. Men can do it. It doesn't have that special connotation that Yeshi has, that something supernatural or some person superior to us must remove the oppressor, must defeat the oppressor. It's not our fight. He's already fought it and won it. We just have to walk in that help zone that faith puts us in. He has defeated the enemy. That's Yeshua. I'm drowning. He can Netzel and Pilat and Barak. He can let me escape. He can pull it apart. But it's not the water that's my problem. It's a problem. It's that shark. That calls for Yeshi, shark fighter, who enters into my situation and defeats it. Nay, has already defeated it. That's why David learned to put the future in the past tense. I said last Sunday of one of the men among many who marked my life and shaped it by exposure, either through their works, their writings, their biographies, or personal encounter. And George Mueller, who never condemned anybody for raising money for orphans, but thought there was so little faith in the land, he had to demonstrate with his life that God was still alive. My life's been built on hard study of the resurrection. And I don't just mouth it. I came to that fixation that day. Certain? Absolutely not. Absolute certainty? Absolutely not. But convinced there was no other explanation, he came out of that tomb. So I would never know until I started acting as though he was alive and with me. And once I crossed the resurrection hurdle, which I did from hard study of resurrection, I'm already out in left field. In this modern age, they talk miracles, but they don't believe it. It's amazing. I was going to play today if I had the time. Something on MSNBC that probably hit the news and you've seen it. Of a memorial on the battlefield for two soldier fellow comrades. What do you think they're singing? From all their varied backgrounds in that situation, what do you think they're singing? Amazing grace, How sweet the sound Do I think every one of those are certain? No. But I think in that situation, they're taking some steps of faith. Likewise, I settled it. And I hung my body on the unseen presence and have these many years. And I've taught you that heroes of faith come to a crossroad. You're going to go with what you see, the insurance policy of the arm of the flesh, or what Psalm 62 says. Alone, only you, you alone are my rock. And since I've been teaching it and living it these many years, I envied my dad who had a miracle that raised him from deathbed and called him to the ministry. Mine was worked out in hard faith. I was jealous of Paul who had the light shine from heaven while I was struggling to get my faith. But thanks be to God, over these years I've seen many lives that are like me and needed a foundation for their faith instead of being told you just got to believe. And had I not walked that path, I wouldn't be able to communicate it. Now in my middle years, I have a new test. Crossed it 2.5 years ago. The devil always comes back if you relax your grip. God made my life have to be an exhibit because I can't preach it if I don't believe it. And I don't know if I believe it until I confront the test. And am I 100% sure? No more than that chair I was sitting in when I laid the last book down. But I said, I'm putting the glasses on of faith, and this is the way I'm walking. And God has walked with me, and I can say what David said in his senior years, my middle years. I love thee, O Lord. The horn. Now you know why the horn is involved in salvation. The horn. And it's the horn of power. The horn of my salvation. They couldn't put it into the Aramaic. They just had to say, my deliverer, Parak. They couldn't put it into the Syriac. They had to say, and deliverer of me, P-R-Q, Parak. When it comes to the Greek, the horn of my salvation, they didn't have a word. Sorry. They had the same problem they had with Arhamka. They did not have a word with heavy theological meaning. They had to borrow from the ancient Greek, and they hunted for a word with literally dozens of words to find this word, sozo, for salvation. Sozo, this is what the Greeks had to supply since they didn't have a word that was restricted to God's own act. This word is traced from Homer and the ancient Greek philosophers clear up to the New Testament. And out of all the words, God inspired his New Testament writers and the translators from the Old Testament into the Greek, the Septuagint, to seize this word. Sozo and soteria means first to save and salvation, in the sense of an acutely dynamic act in which, in ancient Greek, gods or men snatch others. Right there, it loses half of its meaning. You got to put adjectives and adverbs and prepositions in because it's the horn of my salvation. We know that it's not man, it's God, because it's in the context of this Psalm 18 that's speaking of God, who is our rock, who is our rock. I hate these glasses. Is our rock, our shield. But the word in the Greek was gods or men snatch. I want you to remember this. I've told you. Soterion, like the word shalom in the Old Testament, includes health. It is, in its broadest meaning, done by gods or men, and man can't do it if you catch the full deduction and implication. Everything that you were meant to be, and to get on that track that turns us from being and becoming what we were not meant to be, sinners seeking our own way, it has a start, it's continuous, it has a finish, when the God of peace will sanctify us wholly over there. Soterion's a process, a beginning, and constant, ongoing, but it includes health. The sense to save from an illness, hence to cure occurs, of a physician. In a collection of stories, Aesculapius wrote of healings by physicians or medicine. However, the personal or dynamic element of God intervening is not necessarily a part of soterion. It's used even once to translate shalom. It includes keeping, benefiting, preserving. Sozo, about 3/5 of its occurrences, total 162, in the books of the Old Testament, this word is used to render yeshi. The other words, it's used synonymous with these other words for saving. So it doesn't have that strict, careful use that characterizes yeshi. Am I boring you? Well, that's enough. I could read for hours and this be two big tomes. I just want one thought to come through. This is a miraculous act. Give them credit in the Greek. They picked a word that was intense, involved another person saving you, and includes the broad spectrum of deliverance, but it doesn't have that entering in and miraculously working without the context, without the prepositions, without the adjectives, without the adverbs, which most Bible scholars will give you. But simple horn of salvation, most people are going to put on salvation their meaning. Oh, that means once saved, always saved, this recitation I did. That means a trip down here to the altar and a recitation. That means that which was done when I was a kid and they poured water on me. Or it means that which the church does for me, saves me, the Catholic frame where the church and the rituals do the saving, transferred from Christ to the water and transferred from Christ to the elements. It misses that this is warfare. I'm in a prison. I'm in a hopeless state. Glory be to God, not only is He my mother, whom I love, my cleft rock from which flows the open heart of God and access for His saving process, my fortress, my rock foundation, my rescue in the sense of faulty out of any concentration of containment and restriction that lets me free into new life. He is all of those things. I run to Him for shelter. But He's the horn, the power of my salvation. At least, I will tell you, the Latin chooses salvare instead of liberare. Liberare, they caught it. They didn't have the same word as yeshi. But liberare is more to escape. Salvare, they keep that distinction. It's carried forward in the German. They use heil instead of retten or retten or rettung, which is an escape. And the other languages follow suit from either the Latin or the Greek. None of the languages convey what Yishi really is. I can't do it. I face my problems daily, weekly. You face your problems daily, weekly. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. You may say, well, my sickness or your sickness is flesh and blood. Sure. Result of Adam's sin that separated us from the life of God, which kept them healthy. We were not created to be sick. We were created. Well, what about you? You're going to die? Yes. God says for his saints, he just takes their breath away and he chooses the time. But in this veil of tears, sickness doesn't have to accompany us. Does it make us second-class citizens? No. What about the mystery of faith? I don't understand why God seems to give some faith like a child and others of us, like me, have to work hard with it. But I know when the centurion amazed Jesus with his faith, Jesus said, no one in Israel has faith like this. All it took was a word. Centurion says, I'm in authority. I have men under me. I say, go, they go. I say, come, they come. You don't have to come to my house. Just speak the word. Jesus said, I've never seen faith like this. How many in Israel wouldn't treat his word that way? It's what amazed Jesus. This is his word. There are various levels of response. Then from faith to faith, we learn as we go along those crossroads of my strength or his, this rock or him, this fortress or him, this security or him, my saving effort or Yishi. And Yishi, that's the horn of Yishi that enters in my circumstance. I don't care what your problem, as you listen to me, anywhere in the world right now or when this plays its rerun. This can be your prayer. Oh Lord, I love thee, my strength. Oh Lord, my rock, I can stand on your word. You're there. Your word and you are always the same, like Elijah. Fire and earthquake and wind, God wasn't in it, but in his word, still small voice, he's always there. That's my rock, my fortress, impregnable. You mean I'm really impregnable? That's what the promise is. I can be lifted above it. I can dwell in the help zone of the Most High. My release and escape, Umphalti, Palat. I run to you for shelter. Think it's your personal prayer. I seldom pray alone anymore that I don't pour these words out. Open it and read it and make it personal. I run to you for shelter. The horn, my shield, is what I skipped. He surrounds me. I'm protected. I like the Aramaic. The shield was in front of you, which means he sends something that's part of himself to surround me and cover me, surround me with his strength. That verse I had written over there, where trouble is, he sweeps together and excessively presents himself in trouble to surround me with his strength, my shield. And this one, in my need and your need, glory be to God. I may look helpless and you may look helpless and you may feel for a moment you are. Look out. Whatever is the problem that's persecuting you, attacking you, the oppressor, he not only can deliver from the condition, he enters into the scene. That means, let's take my personal problem. If I didn't have it, this cancer that came back, there'd be no reason for me to pray for for this need. No reason for him to enter with his power in my body and knock the shillelagh out of cancer cells. And I will say what I said for the 2.5 years the first time. Thanks be to God for the cancer. It drove me to him, as F.B. Meyer says. Not that pressure will kill you if it drives you from God. If it drives you to God, it makes you. I will be singing as David did for years to come. He has been, he is, and he will be. The horn of my salvation, God the subject, intensively and miraculously moving on the scene with the horn of his power in my condition to destroy the oppressor that creates the condition. That's my promise and yours. Live it. And that's my message today.